Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Question, is the Republican Party coming apart in a battle over Donald Trump? After the release of that tape of Trump bragging about groping women, many lawmakers dropped their support like a hot potato. But Nebraska's Deb Fischer, who initially said Trump should step aside, has picked that potato back up. Here she is on KLIN Radio this morning.
I support the Republican ticket, and I plan to vote for Mr. Trump and Mr. Pence on November 8th. I know you know I put out a statement on Friday, and it was with regard to Mr. Trump's comments. I felt they were disgusting. I felt they were unacceptable. But I never said I was not voting for our Republican ticket.
Well, USA Today contacted all Republican members of Congress and all Republican governors and found 1 in 4 do not support Trump, and Trump continues to bash them. That includes House Speaker Paul Ryan and Arizona Senator John McCain. Here's Trump last night with Fox News' Bill O'Reilly talking about McCain.
He was begging for my endorsement. His friends are calling.
Be the bigger man.
The first sign of a little bit of difficulty, he unendorses.
All right.
I wouldn't want to be in a foxhole with a lot of these people. That I can tell you.
But McCain's a brave man.
Including Ryan.
He's a brave man, McCain.
By the way, including Ryan, especially
I got
Ryan.
That.
Susan Page is Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Robin.
And now we're going to dig deep into Republican Party history tomorrow with an historian. But have you seen anything like this in modern history?
Man, I haven't. This is my 10th campaign. We're seeing a Republican Party, one of the major parties, in a civil war. We thought that was going to come after the election. It started about a month early. I think even if you go back to like the 1964 election, which was a tough election for Republicans, they did not have the flight of the Republican elite from their nominee the way we're seeing today with Donald Trump.
Well, your paper report said Fred Malik, the strategist and chair of the party's Governors Association, says this is not about Trump, or that this is about Trump and not a deeper fissure in the party. Is he right? What are you hearing?
Fred Malik is a great guy and a smart guy, but I would disagree with him on this. I think there is a big division between the Trump supporters who provide the energy of the party this year, who have managed to deliver the nomination to Donald Trump, and the elected Republicans that we contacted over the last couple days to see what they were thinking. We found more than a third of Republican governors are not supporting Trump. More than a third of Republican senators are not supporting Trump. He gets bigger support down in House races, which tend to be all one party or the other. But in places where Republicans need to appeal to both Republicans and independent voters in the middle, Trump's lack of support, the flight from Trump, is really extraordinary.
Well, some other strategists, Republican strategists, are telling you this is just the Republican Party becoming diverse. It's usually been lockstep. But can the party be both anti-trade, as Trump is, and pro-trade, as the party's been? Can it be led by a leader who speaks ill of the disabled and also be a party with deep moral convictions?
Well, you know, the Republican Party has traditionally had some diversity, not so much racial diversity, but it's included kind of Main Street Republicans who have conservative economic views. Socially conservative evangelical Christians have been an important part. So it's had a kind of big tent in some past years, especially the years when it's actually managed to win elections. This is something different. These are parts of the party at war with one another. And that raises questions that won't be addressed immediately, will have to be addressed over time about what does the Republican Party stand for? Who is the face of the Republican Party? Is it Donald Trump, or is it Paul Ryan, or is it someone else?
Well, meantime, Donald Trump is the candidate. And Politico spoke with Trump biographers. They say this is the man they wrote about. One called him a very dangerous man for the next 3 or 4 weeks. What's your interpretation of that?
Well, for one thing, I think Donald Trump is beginning to realize that he is likely to lose this election. So how does he want to go out? And it seems to me what we've seen in the last couple of days, and particularly in that second debate on Sunday night, is a man who's ready to burn the house down, that he is going to come after Republicans who have not supported him. And he's going after Hillary Clinton in increasingly personal ways. This new ad that makes fun of her health, that suggests she's not strong enough, doesn't have the stamina to be president. That's just one more extraordinary attack on Hillary Clinton that will raise issues for her, might suppress her turnout, and may make it harder for her to govern if she ends up winning in November.
That's Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. Susan, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, if you were thinking about a trip to London, now might be the time. The British pound is now worth about $1.20, down from $1.55 last year. And it keeps on falling as the reality of Britain's vote to leave the European Union starts to sink in. Sebastian Payne is editor at the Financial Times. He joins us from London. Welcome.
Hi.
And we may have expected this kind of a drop right after the Brexit vote, but here we are months later and the pound is diving against the dollar. What's going on?
So the key thing to remember is that Britain has not actually left the European Union yet, and nothing has changed in its relationship with Brussels. And that's why the markets and the pound did drop quite immediately after, from about 169 down to about 114. It's now down to about 120 against the dollar. And the key point for that is that it's uncertainty. The markets care about uncertainty. And what we've seen over the past 2 weeks is the Prime Minister, Theresa May, announcing that Britain is going to activate Article 50. That is the key mechanism for Britain to leave the EU before the end of March 2017. That's when the real uncertainty begins, and this is what's affected sterling so badly.
But the fact that it's been affected so much makes you think that people in Britain thought that Theresa May wasn't going to actually activate Article 50, that she wasn't going to. Did people think that Britain wasn't going to really leave the EU?
I think there was a case of waiting and seeing, to be honest. The other thing as well is that it's not just the fact we're leaving the EU, it's what kind of Brexit, because there's a big political debate here about, do we have what's called a hard Brexit? That means a clean break, cutting all ties with Brussels. Or do we have a soft Brexit, which would be continuing some kind of relationship with Brussels? Based on comments the Prime Minister made at her party conference last week, it seems we're very much going for a hard Brexit. And people really don't like the idea of that, because that means full withdrawal from the European single market and the customs union, and ending free movement of people, which will have significant consequences for the British economy.
And I guess the question is that a negotiating position? Is she putting that out there right now? But in fact, in the end, Britain and the EU will meet somewhere in the middle.
I think that's the hope of many people in the city and across the country, that she's beginning from a tough position. But I think it's not really in anybody's interest to have this hard Brexit, because it would damage the European economy, because they would have 15% of their budget would disappear overnight. It would also damage the British economy for the reasons that I said before. So I think this could be a negotiating position, but we just don't know.
Is there regret among the general population in the UK? Are people feeling like this was the wrong decision?
None whatsoever. There's no polling and there's no data to show that anyone regrets the vote to leave the EU. In fact, some people who voted Remain said they wished they'd voted for Brexit. And I think there's a slight concern here that when the big uncertainty begins, that's when the buyer's remorse starts. But I think the fact that we've seen a quick transition to a new prime minister, and, you know, the sun's still shining, the shops are still open, people have still got food, so they don't really feel there's much to be regretful about right now. But that could change very quickly.
And if that does change, is there a possibility of another vote?
I think it's quite unlikely to have another referendum. You know, it was a 1.5 million majority, which is, you know, obviously pretty big in British terms of the electorate. And I think across the main political parties, there is a consensus. People have voted to leave the EU. We now need to get on with it. We don't want to revisit the question and seem undemocratic or subverting the will of the people. What is possible is a general election based on the deal. So if Theresa May and her ministers go to Brussels, they come back with a deal. They then might take that deal to the general public to get an endorsement to go ahead, push ahead that deal and leave the EU on those terms. If the government lost that referendum, that could then throw into the question of reopening negotiations or revisiting the question. But there is very little appetite, I should say, in Westminster at the moment to have another referendum. It was a very bruising contest and it has divided the whole country along those 52-48% lines the way people voted in June 23rd.
Meanwhile, let's get back to the pound. How is that affecting people in Britain? Or does it at all that the value of the pound has dropped so much? Obviously, there's a lot of international travel on the part of Brits, but are you feeling it?
Not particularly day to day. I think nothing's really changed. The inflation's remained pretty steady. Prices haven't rose a lot. There's, you know, the economy, the FTSE's remaining buoyant. And we've had good indications from the data on the services and manufacturing industry. As you said, the key question is imports and exports, that it very much helps exports from the UK. And we're expecting the data that will come out towards the end of the year to show that they have benefited well from that. But imports are obviously going to be far more expensive, and travel is going to be a lot more expensive too. And I think that at some British airports now, it's you get less than £1 for €1 when you take into account all the costs. And I think that has alarmed people to a certain extent. And the question everyone's scratching their heads on now is, how low is the pound going to go? But it's all really too soon to say. We don't have much hard data. It feels fine. It doesn't feel like we're entering economic turmoil. But again, it's just really too soon to say.
That's Sebastian Payne with the Financial Times in London. Sebastian, thank you.
Thank you.
This week, we've been talking about K through 12 education. Yesterday, we heard from the Teacher of the Year. And today, our focus is on inequality. There's a significant achievement gap between rich and poor students, as well as between Black and Latino students and white students. Joining us to discuss is Daniel Lozen, director of the Center for Civil Rights Remedies, an initiative at the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
And how much inequality exists right now in the public schools in this country?
Well, of course, that depends on how you measure inequality. If you're looking at who has access to effective teachers, you see pretty profound differences along lines of race and class. If you look at who's being kicked out of school for even minor offenses of the school discipline code, you see really shockingly disparate rates for Black students, girls and boys, but also students with disabilities, English learners, and other subgroups. If you're looking at where schools are getting adequate resources, you find that we still have entrenched patterns of racial and socioeconomic isolation, especially in urban areas, and they are oftentimes underfunded. And we even have situations like in Ohio, where the state Supreme Court said their distribution of school finance and resources is unconstitutional, yet the state legislature has failed to remedy the situation.
So still a lot of problems exist, but which way are the trend lines going? Are things getting more unequal or more equal?
Well, in terms of patterns of segregation and racial isolation, they're actually getting worse. In terms of school discipline, there's been a greater awareness that kicking kids out of school is actually counterproductive. If we're looking at who has access to effective teachers, I don't have the historical data, but it's still a very, very entrenched pattern. And these things are oftentimes connected. You know, you see the access to teacher issue more pronounced in racially isolated districts, as well as higher suspension rates. So it's not like these are isolated problems.
Well, you've mentioned suspension rates several times. Let's talk about that specifically. What are you talking about there, and why is that so critical in terms of the inequality question?
So what we're finding from research is that getting suspended out of school is actually one of the leading predictors of whether students drop out of school eventually. It also obviously denies access to instruction. And we know from research on chronic absenteeism, for example, that even missing 3 days of school in 1 year at the fourth grade, after controlling for other factors, predicted a lower reading level by a full grade level. So it's really important in terms of closing the achievement gap is related to closing the discipline gap, because we are seeing schools where 25%, 30%, 40% of African-American youth, of students with disabilities, even in preschools, we're seeing huge disparities. Even the numbers are obviously lower, but we're seeing really large racial disparities. And it also reflects a problem in terms of inequality that was actually brought up in one of the presidential debates around policing, which is this concept of implicit bias. So that's oftentimes confused with intentional discrimination. Implicit bias is really the way stereotypes infect our perceptions and judgments about what we're seeing and how to respond to it. And so there was a recent study by Yale where they looked at implicit bias among preschool teachers, Black and white, and found that when they were prompted to look for possible misbehavior, even though what they were looking at was actually students who were all well-behaved, most of the time the eyes went to the black boys, black preschool boys. So it starts early, but you can see how that could contribute to some of the problems that we're seeing.
And the solution would be what, just to not suspend kids? Because I imagine if you were to go to these individual schools and say, on an individual basis,
right. Did
this person deserve to be suspended? Well, here's what they did. Here's why we suspended them.
Oftentimes, there's this dichotomy. Is it chaos on the one hand or kicking kids out of school on the other? In fact, I have a book that is a compilation of researchers' findings from around the country about what works instead. And it really shows that there's a whole range of things that you can do in terms of teaching appropriate behavior, but also training and supporting teachers to find more effective ways to engage students. And these also have the impact of reducing the racial disparities. So there's a lot that folks can do. I was a teacher for over 10 years. And, you know, my first year, I was that teacher that was kicking kids out right and left, sending them to the principal's office. But I also received the kind of training that is outlined in the research, where I learned to be a better educator, better classroom manager, but also more effective in delivering instruction. And behavioral problems went down a lot. And then those that remained, I had the tools to address them much more successfully.
What about the economic part of this, that people that live in richer neighborhoods are paying more property taxes, they have more money going into the schools, and people that live in poorer neighborhoods don't? Is there any way to fix that problem?
Well, one suggestion has been to not make school resources based on property taxes. The only caution there is that in many of the wealthier and whiter suburbs, there's actually adequate resources. So we don't want to, by level of the playing field, also lower the level of resources. So we would have to have a strong commitment to providing an adequate resources for children wherever they're located. But I also think it's important to connect this with housing. There's a legacy of housing discrimination and redlining and other barriers to have integrated communities. And we oftentimes, when we talk about equity in education, we leave diversity off the table when it's really centrally important for making the kinds of big structural changes that are going to be needed to get to a real fair and just system of public education in the United States.
Just last month, a court in Connecticut ruled that state's method of funding public schools was unconstitutional and that the state was defaulting on its constitutional duty to provide an adequate education to all children because there are such disparities between wealthy and poor school districts. When you heard that, did you think, oh, Connecticut's really doing a bad job? Or, you know, if any court in any state looked at what's going on, they'd probably find a similar thing.
I think they would find a similar thing in most states. What's interesting about Connecticut is that there is a standing desegregation order that has been partially but not fully implemented. So, for example, students in Hartford, there are magnet schools that bring white students from the suburbs into Hartford, but there's also a choice program where students there can go to school in the suburbs. And that's been really quite successful. But it really goes to what is the remedy? Unfortunately, the judge in Connecticut wasn't able to spell out any specific remedies. But at the bottom line is what he was saying is really important, that we all have a responsibility to educate all children as if they are our own children. Until we get to that kind of approach to these problems, I think we're going to see a lot of the inequities persist.
And what's at stake? How much of a difference does it make for a student that goes through the most high-end schools, public schools, but rich public schools at the end of their time in those public schools versus a student that's going to some of the worst schools in the country?
Well, the differences are quite profound when we've looked at things like the cost of not graduating. And there's huge disparities by race where, you know, African-American and Latino students are oftentimes graduating around 60% of their entering, you know, freshman high school class. And it's much closer to 90% nationally for most other subgroups. And what that means in terms of our economy is that we don't have the kinds of workforce where in upwardly mobile kinds of jobs that require the kind of critical thinking or technical background or mathematical or science skills to be successful. And so there's a huge drain on our economy. Our failure to educate all students also contributes to our mass incarceration. You know, we put more people behind bars than any other country by far.
Right.
And part of the problem is, you know, a long time ago, the Supreme Court said there is no federal, they didn't recognize in the Constitution a federal right to an education. And many states do have a right to an education, but when it comes down to how it's interpreted, unfortunately, not enough states have been, like in Connecticut, the Supreme Courts in many states have not said we're not meeting our obligation to students.
These days, so many people decide that they're not even going to go with the public schools. Instead,
right,
they are going to send their kids to private schools. How much damage does that do to the public schools?
Well, that's a difficult question because, you know, you can't say to parents, you have to put your children in a public school system. But what I think it really is a reflection of is when we fail to provide an adequate education to all kids, those with the means will make sure their kids get an adequate education.
And does that hurt the public schools?
So it absolutely does hurt the public schools, just the way there's concerns about charter schools creaming. You know, the idea that the folks with the most resources are pulling their children out, it's not necessarily so much about their children, but it really speaks to the lack of political will in terms of improving public schools. Unfortunately, I think that's short-sighted. Even the wealthiest who might put their child in a private school aren't realizing the public good, the benefit to all of us to having a well-educated population and what that means to businesses, but also to it goes to the fabric of our democracy.
That's Daniel Lozen, director of the Center for Civil Rights Remedies, an initiative at the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And many of us have had complaints with our cable company. But now the FCC has slapped cable giant Comcast with a $2.3 million fine, the largest penalty ever imposed on a cable company. And it's for charging customers for things they didn't ask for. Here now is Peter O'Dowd, has been looking into this. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Robin. How you doing?
I'm fine. And we're understanding that the FCC has been investigating complaints against Comcast for several years now. They say as many as 1,000. Why? What are people complaining about?
Well, yeah, it's been 2 years, and imagine if you got your cable bill and you looked at it and there were things on there that you expressly did not want. So we're talking about premium channels. We're talking about cable boxes, DVRs. In many cases, these customers who saw these charges on their bill told Comcast they didn't want it. When they tried to get the charges taken off of their bill, it took either a long time for Comcast to address the problem or it just didn't get fixed in
okay.
the first place.
So there's a fine. Also, Comcast is being told they've got to compensate or address complaints from customers.
Yeah, Comcast has to basically step in, notify customers that it's making changes. It has to keep track of what's going on. And so it's not just about this fine, which is $2.3 million for a huge company like Comcast, probably not that big of a deal. But it puts Comcast on notice that they need to notify their customers of what's going on, and they have to respond when there's a problem and a customer comes forward.
Right. And now, if you are one of these customers, you can't have your account referred to a collection agency or suspended because you have one of these disputed charges. Look, customer service problems are not new for Comcast. Consumerist called it the worst company in America in 2014. Horror stories out there. Tell us some of them.
Well, there was a woman in Chicago who called Comcast a couple years ago and told Comcast, look, I'm not getting my bill. And when in written correspondence that came back to this woman, the employees of the company were using derogatory terms to greet her, essentially making up a fake name for her.
In writing.
In writing.
Right.
So this is a problem that Comcast knows it has. I mean, I spent a little time on the company's Facebook page today, and you can see a lot of what they're dealing with. I guess a lot of what any cable company is dealing with on a pretty regular basis is unhappy customers. I mean, it's an unpopular industry. Yeah. Comcast knows it has a problem. And David Cohen is the executive vice president. He told the Washington Post that it bothers us that we have so much trouble delivering high quality of service to customers on a regular basis. So this is nothing necessarily new to
right.
Comcast. They've got a lot of work to
but
do.
But do they? I mean, they've got a fine. They've got this terrible PR. But do they really have to make a change? They're so big.
Well, I mean, what do you want to do? If you want to watch TV, you've got a couple of options. You can go the old route, the big behemoth cable companies. Or, you know, there's a lot of conversation these days about cutting the cord. You know, even in Congress, there's been talk about these a la carte options where you only pay for what it is that you want to watch on TV. And so I think that the cable companies are probably responding to this. They have to be a little bit more cognizant of what the consumers are looking for.
Right, because there are other choices out there. Look, I'm just a quick note. We have Wells Fargo, which paid a huge fine after it was discovered that it was selling credit cards to customers that didn't want them. And now maybe you're getting a DVR, you know, or some sort of a service from Comcast you didn't want. Maybe the underlying story here, maybe really check your bills.
Pay attention to the bill. Yeah.
Here now is Peter O'Dowd. Thank you, Peter.
You're welcome.
And we are gratified to often hear public radio save my life. But in our next story, it really did. Let's bring in first Cynthia Ravitsky from Westerville, Ohio. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I can't wait for you to tell this story. About a month ago, we were interviewing best-selling author Gail Forman about her new book, Leave Me. It's a story of a working mother of twins so busy she doesn't slow down for what turns out to be a heart attack. How could that ever happen? And you're stuck in traffic listening on public radio's WOSU, where you are right now. So start the story. What are you hearing Gail Forman say?
Well, I was listening to your show, thankfully, and she was talking about her book, which was fascinating. And then she started delving into a bit more detail about the symptoms that women often experience when they're having a heart attack and how they are surprisingly different from our stereotypical view of heart attack victims. It's not the typical clutching the chest with horrendous pain and pressure and collapsing.
It's classic, like you have the pain in your left arm and you clutch it and you then pass out. And for a lot of women, it's just this sort of nausea that comes on, or it's this low-grade pain.
What I was thinking was, how strange. I'm feeling something a little odd right now in my chest as she's speaking. I was feeling kind of a pinching inside my chest. It wasn't really pain, but I was aware of it. And I thought, I'm just having maybe a little muscle spasm, but I didn't think of my heart. As I continued driving, I started feeling a little tingling in my right arm. It was kind of like pins and needles, as if my arm were falling asleep. And I didn't, again, associate that with my heart because it was my right arm. And I thought I was just kind of leaning on the console and maybe my arm was falling asleep. So I didn't associate it with my heart.
Right.
I was thinking, well, I have to get to work and I'll just, you know, stop at the doctor's on the way home from work. I had to get to work to teach a class. Then I suddenly broke out in a cold sweat and felt very nauseous, very sick to my stomach. And that's when I actually started being more concerned that there was something going on right at that moment.
Then Gail Forman goes on to start talking about her own brush with heart problems. Her mother had them as well. She's on a family vacation. She's having symptoms. But as she told us, she's hiding upstairs Googling these symptoms. Let's listen.
And as I waited to, I didn't call an ambulance, which is very stupid, and people should actually call if they're in that situation.
Okay. You're thinking what, Cynthia? Yeah.
I kept hearing Gail say not to ignore the symptoms. Don't ignore the symptoms. So I made the decision to call work, cancel my class. I knew I was pretty close to Licking Memorial Hospital, which is in Newark, Ohio. So I called 911. I did not ask for a squad, which under normal circumstances would have been the best thing to do, I think. But because there was this big traffic jam, I was afraid if the squad tried to get to me, they'd get stuck in traffic. I'd be stuck in traffic. So I just called 911 and asked them for directions to the hospital. And I made it to the hospital in about 5 minutes. It was very close.
What did you say when you walked into the hospital?
Well, first of all, I parked the car. I had to find a parking spot. I didn't want to block the ER entrance.
Oh, we're so accommodating.
Well, you know, because I didn't know. I didn't know what was happening. So I parked the car and I walked into the ER, looked around, and I saw there was a reception area. So I went up to the desk And kind of sheepishly, I said to the woman sitting there, I think I may be having a heart attack. And right away, I kind of collapsed. I couldn't stand up anymore. Oh, wow. It hit me all at once. They brought me a wheelchair. They whisked me back into an exam room.
And they told you, you were in fact
in the middle of having a heart attack.
All right. Let's bring in Dr. Lakshmi Mehta, director of the Women's Cardiovascular Health Program and an associate professor of medicine at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Dr. Mehta, you've heard Cynthia's story. I mean, there's so many things that we're hearing here, you know, everything that Gail Forman wrote about in her book. How common is this that women just kind of say, I don't want to, you know, put anybody out. It's probably nothing. It's probably gas, when it's a heart attack?
It's very common. Many women dismay their symptoms. And the problem is that the symptoms are not typical necessarily. Most women do have chest pain, not to say that they dispel chest pain, but when they have the atypical symptoms, they tend to ignore it. And women tend to be more involved with those around them than their own health, and that becomes problematic. So finding time to take care of your child or your spouse or your parent or friend's health seems more important than your own. And so it's common for women to dispel their own symptoms and urge their loved ones to see the doctor right away, but to delay their own care.
Right. This is what Gail Forman's terrific novel is about, a woman who's so concerned about who's going to pick up the kids at school. It's a big concern, but meanwhile, she was having a heart attack. Look, we talk about the symptoms. Give us the range.
The most common symptom is still going to be chest pain, but it doesn't have to be the elephant on the chest and left-sided or middle of the chest. People can have chest pain on the right side of their chest. They can present with back pain, shoulder pain, arm pain, intense fatigue, nausea, vomiting, intense heartburn.
Feels like the flu. It sounds like the flu. Yeah.
Yes. So the key is to know what's normal for your body. And if something is new and different, and especially worse with exertion, you need to seek immediate medical attention. It's better for us doctors to decide what it is rather than the patient themselves.
Right. Actually, there has been, as you said, a push to increase knowledge about how women's heart attacks present differently and how women tend to fall back on certain behavior when they have a heart attack. I interviewed my now very close dear friend, Barbara Streisand, about this. She has a campaign called Fight the Lady Killer. So we'll link you to that at hereandnow.org. But meanwhile, let's bring back in Cynthia Ravitsky. So Cynthia, you're hearing the doctor say that what you did is very common. You did have treatment. You seem to be doing quite well. What did the doctor say to you? What if you hadn't gone?
Well, as it turned out, it was my right coronary artery that was blocked. They took me right up to the cath lab, and he told me I had a 99.9% blockage in the right coronary artery. So it was critical that they get in there immediately and open up the artery with a balloon, and then they put a stent in. Certainly, if I hadn't gone when I did, there would have been significant damage to the heart muscle if I had survived. And, of course, the outcome would have been unknown at that point because it depends upon how long you delay and what happens in the interim.
Yeah. Well, and Lakshmi Mehta, if someone is feeling right now, geez, I thought it was indigestion, you know, we're told don't go to the emergency room. You know, you want to be preventive rather than go in for every ache and pain. That's another message that we get. What's the worst that can happen if you go to an emergency room and it is food poisoning or indigestion and not a heart attack?
The worst thing is that you've just spent some time in the emergency room. But it's important because many times people can miss heart attacks and sit at home with indigestion, and it's what we call a silent heart attack. What's important about the shows that you've done, though, is that there has been significant media on heart attacks in women. What are the signs and symptoms? Really a strong push, not only for the public to be aware, but the medical community to take the stories seriously and to understand these atypical symptoms. So we've seen in the last almost two decades a dramatic drop in the number of deaths from heart attacks in women. Yeah. And so that's remarkable.
Yep. Well, we have to give all the credit to Gail Forman, who decided to write a terrific book about it. It's called Leave Me. And Cynthia, I don't know what they've said to you at WOSU, But as far as I'm concerned, from here on out, you do not have to support public radio. You have done your bit.
I feel like I owe WOSU and NPR, Gail Forman, and you my life. So I am your biggest supporter ever and will continue to be. And I just, from my own standpoint, I'm hoping that it helps other women out there who might be wondering if they should get checked out. Don't ignore the symptoms.
That is Cynthia Ravitsky. She teaches math at Ohio State in Newark, Ohio, and was on her way to class about a month ago listening to Here and Now when she heard author Gail Forman describing the symptoms of a heart attack in women, and turns out Cynthia was having one. Cynthia, we're thrilled to be able to talk to you, considering the alternative. Dr. Mehta, thank you as well. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And you listeners, we appreciate you. If you're listening and feeling the symptoms, go.
If control of the House of Representatives is going to flip to the Democrats, it'll be because of districts like Texas's 23rd. That's where Republican Congressman Will Hurd joined many of his colleagues over the weekend in calling on Donald Trump to abandon his presidential run. Hurd is facing a challenge from the man he beat 2 years ago, former Congressman Pete Gallego, and Texas's 23rd is where we turn for this week's District Profile. That's our weekly look at House races across the country. And joining us now is Aaron Schrank, a reporter at Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, Jeremy. How's it going?
It's going well. And this very strong rebuke from Will Hurd came after that tape surfaced from Donald Trump. Is this expected to impact the race?
Yeah, so up until this weekend, Will Hurd was sort of threading the needle when it came to Trump. He hadn't endorsed him. He hadn't condemned him. He mostly avoided saying Trump's name, to be honest. But then after the Access Hollywood tapes made the rounds, Hurd called Trump's comments, quote, utterly sickening. He said he can't vote for Trump, and yes, that Trump should, quote, step aside for a true conservative to beat Hillary Clinton. It's hard to know exactly what impact these audio tapes will have on the congressional race. Trump is already pretty unpopular in this district. It's a majority Latino district that includes hundreds of miles of the Texas-Mexican border. But Trump has been a big factor in the campaign rhetoric in this race already. Democrat Pete Gallego and his backers are running a lot of ads about Trump, hoping that there are enough voters here angry about Trump's immigration and border security rhetoric who might show up and vote against Trump and Republican Will Hurd.
Well, let's hear more about these two candidates. Will Hurd was born and raised in San Antonio. He served as an undercover CIA officer in the Middle East and Asia. What are some of the issues that he's been talking about?
Yeah, Will Hurd is the only member of Congress who has served as an active CIA officer during the War on Terror. He has cybersecurity expertise and is also focused on border security issues. He hopes that his Homeland Security expertise play well here in this district where there are a large number of veterans and active military. Here's Will Hurd touting his support for that key constituency at a recent campaign event in San Antonio.
You know, these veterans stood up for us, and we're going to continue to stand up for them. And this is something that's very important to my campaign. We've helped over 500 veterans deal with the VA in some former fashion. This is something I'm proud of, and this is something that we're going to continue.
And Hurd is saying those things as his opponent is drawing attention to comments by Donald Trump that may not play well among veterans, things like what Trump has said about Captain Khan, John McCain, and PTSD, for example. But it's important to know that Hurd is something of a rising star in the Republican Party. He's one of three black Republicans in Congress. He's popular, but he is definitely vulnerable this year because he only beat Democrat Pete Gallego by 2 percentage points in their first matchup last election.
Well, let's hear about Pete Gallego. He represented the district from 2012 to 2014, and he lost to Will Hurd. What issues is he talking about?
Yeah, Gallego is a lawyer from Alpine, Texas, one of many small towns in this massive congressional district that goes all the way from San Antonio to El Paso. He was in the Texas State House for more than 20 years, representing this southwest border region that includes some of the same constituents in this congressional District 23. He, too, is talking about veterans issues, border issues, education, small business. But to be honest, the main issue he's choosing to talk about on the campaign trail is the Republican presidential nominee. Trump's comments and policy positions are the subject of a lot of Pete Gallego's ads and public speeches. But here's what Gallego told me at a San Antonio campaign stop when I asked him what his campaign was about other than Trump.
Well, I think the entire campaign is really based on security and different facets of security, whether that's economic security, whether that's border security, whether that's, I mean, we all want the opportunity to make our families better, to know that our sons and daughters are going to be able to get educated and go out and get better jobs so that we can continue to build that American dream.
Gallego is playing up the fact that he understands the border and he believes that Trump helps him reinforce that point for voters. He also talks about the environment. Gallego has been called a clean energy champion by the Sierra Club. He was at one point in this race going after Will Hurd for supporting a border security bill that would have added roads to Big Bend National Park with exemptions from environmental laws. Overall, if you talk to Pete Gallego, he's confident that if he can get Democrats to show up for a presidential election like they usually do, then he can get the seat back, as Democrats have in the last two presidential election years.
And what do the polls say right now?
So there hasn't been a ton of polling in this race, but a poll commissioned by the Texas Democratic Party released back in July had Democrat Pete Gallego leading by 8 points. But the race is one of just two dozen races or so nationwide that are considered toss-ups by pundits. It's gone back and forth every election since 2010 between Democrats and Republicans. So it's expected to be a very close race. One thing we can look at is Republican incumbent Hurd has a fundraising advantage of about 2-1 based on the most recent filings. But in the past, we've seen that that doesn't necessarily lead to a win in this district.
That's Aaron Schrank, a reporter at Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, talking with us about the 23rd congressional district in Texas and the race there. Aaron, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.